From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
A major moment on Capitol Hill. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. A president who won office in part with the promise of ending wars now faces a historic rebuke of his call for limited military action in Syria. But that's not all. The Senate and Congress have 9 working days till a possible government shutdown and a debt default that threatens the global economy. There's a chance Obamacare will become a distraction, and that immigration reform may be put off till the next president is in office. There's more issues left than Congress can handle when it's working well. Is America's most unpopular institution up to the job? Today's talking point, not one, but 2 new iPhones from Apple. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney back with To the Point. It's not just Syria. One veteran congressman calls this an amazing time. Obamacare, immigration reform, a possible government shutdown, and defaulting on the national debt are all on the table as Congress returns from the August recess. We'll get some progress reports. Today's talking point, Apple will be announcing a new iPhone tomorrow with new technology and a higher price. Why is it also announcing another cheaper new iPhone model at the same time? First, this news update. Secretary of State John Kerry said today that Syria's President Assad could avert an attack by handing over all his chemical weapons to the UN in 1 week. Russia then urged Assad to do that, and Assad said that might be a good idea. Here's the first White House reaction from Tony Blinken, the president's deputy national security advisor.
We're going to take a hard look at this. We'll talk to the Russians about it, but I think it's finally, it's very important to note that it's clear that this proposal comes in the context of the threat of U.S. action and the pressure that the president is exerting. So it's even more important that we don't take the pressure off and that Congress give the president the authority he's requested.
Ken Delanian is intelligence and national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren.
Tell us how feasible, to use a word the president applied to it last week in St. Petersburg, this idea might be.
It's not clear how feasible to do it in a week, and it's interesting. It's been greeted in some quarters as a massive gaffe by Kerry because it just, under the theory that it just gives Syria and the Russians a chance to delay and obfuscate and avoid a military strike. On the other hand, I just got a news release from Senator Dianne Feinstein, who chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee, embracing the idea and saying, hey, maybe this can work to avert the strike. So it may give some members of Congress who are reluctant to vote for these strikes an out.
You mentioned this timeline. In a week, it's my understanding that there are hundreds of tons of material stashed all over Syria. And one person suggested that you'd have to sort of take a pause in all of the fighting in order for the UN inspectors to go around and gather it up.
Well, exactly right. So, presumably this is something that could be negotiated. But the question is, whether the sides could trust each other enough to negotiate a verifiable agreement like this.
You said that Kerry may have made a gaffe at the same time that he made the proposal. Didn't he back off a bit, saying it was really more a debate point than a serious ultimatum?
I didn't actually hear that part of it. So you may be right, and certainly the White House and others, the State Department spokesperson, are sort of being very careful and pointing out that this is only under duress that they're making this proposal, and they're treating it very cautiously.
Well, if Dianne Feinstein embraces this, chair of the Intelligence Committee in the Senate, Senator, of course, senior senator from California, does this suggest that Congress might take a look at this and say, wait a minute, maybe we don't have to vote on this after all?
Well, they're certainly taking a look at it, yeah, because, the momentum in Congress in terms of supporting these strikes doesn't seem to be going the president's way, and there's a lot of people very reluctant to vote for this. So I'm sure that many members will grab at this as a way to maybe slow things down.
Tony Blinken says that when members of Congress see all the evidence, they will realize there is no doubt about the use of chemical weapons. In Damascus, over the weekend, before today's news about turning over the chemical arsenal, President Assad spoke with Charlie Rose of CBS News.
If there's an attack, you know, what might be the repercussions and who might be engaged in those repercussions?
Before the 11th of September, in my discussion with many officials in the United States, some of them are congressmen, I used to say that don't deal with the terrorists as playing games. It's a different story. You're going to pay the price if you're not wise.
He talks of terrorists, of course. By that, he means what we refer to as the rebels. But the idea that there is a price to pay is something that would appear to be addressed to the American people.
Absolutely. That was a very savvy interview from what excerpts we've heard of it, speaking in very measured tones in English directly to the concerns of the American public and Congress about this whole enterprise. And you know, he also sort of questioned, where is the evidence that my government carried out these strikes? And frankly, you know, we haven't actually seen the evidence. My intelligence sources and congressional sources tell me the evidence that they've seen in classified settings is solid. You know, there are intercepts, there's satellite information, there's human sourcing. But because it's classified intelligence, they haven't made any of it public. And so, you know, it's there are some questions about how strong the evidence is.
Now, they're also saying that a lot of the members of Congress that are expressing doubts haven't really seen all of that evidence because, of course, they've been on recess, even though there have been these various sessions. And they're going into session tonight, are they not, in order to see more?
Yeah, and everybody who's been in these briefings tends to come away convinced that, in fact, yes, this was a chemical weapons attack by the Assad regime. But for some reason, you know, the decision's been made not to make specific items of evidence public, like, you know, phone recordings of phone intercepts or whatever.
In the meantime, Assad, showing his savvy, you said this was a savvy interview, made a reference to 9/11.
Yeah, you know, a veiled threat. We could read it as a veiled threat that very unpredictable and dangerous and damaging things could happen to the U.S. if it pursues this military strike.
Okay. Obviously, everybody pointing in different directions. Ken Delaney, it's great to have you on our program, and thanks a lot for joining us.
Warren, thanks for having me.
Again with the Los Angeles Times. Back in a moment with a major moment on Capitol Hill for more reasons than one. It's not just Syria. To the point.
KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Congress is back from the August recess, facing so much unfinished business that veteran members call it amazing. On the top of the list, of course, is Syria and the president's call for limited action to punish the Assad regime's alleged use of chemical weapons against its own people. Molly Ball with The Atlantic magazine has been reporting on what leaders of both parties are calling a conscience vote. Molly Ball, it's always good to have you on our show.
Great to be here.
I think I need to make a mention to our listeners that it's mid-afternoon in Washington. This story is developing so rapidly that I think it's important that they know just when we are talking, because things are happening thick and fast, as we just heard about this proposal by the Russians, which first by John Kerry, then by the Russians, now with Assad taking it up, that there might be a chance to avoid a problem if he can somehow collect all of his chemical weapons and turn them over to the UN. Do you think Molly Ball, with Dianne Feinstein now apparently embracing this idea, at least for the moment, is there a chance that the Congress might seize on this to avoid a vote?
Well, some members of Congress already have been pushing proposals to take some alternative action to a strike. As you mentioned, the White House is pressing ahead, saying that the pressure needs to be kept on and that this and that this might be a diversionary tactic. Obviously, there is no trust between the United States and the Russians. And so anything that they are planning to broker or to do would be viewed with suspicion. So this doesn't seem to be changing the administration's calculus at this point. But if it actually bears fruit, and there's a lot of skepticism about that, if there are concrete steps taken, you've got to think that would change the calculus.
On the other hand, as we heard earlier, there are apparently, as there's so much volume of chemical weapons around Syria, that it certainly couldn't be done in a week, as Secretary Kerry suggested at the outset. Do you think that members of Congress will see this as a gaffe by the Secretary of State?
I'm not sure what you're referring to. I'm sorry.
Okay. We just heard from our earlier guest. You weren't on the air as yet, that there are those who believe that by saying that if Syria could collect its chemical weapons and put them under somebody else's authority in a week, then there would be a possibility of not having a strike. And our earlier guest, Ken Delanian of the Los Angeles Times, said that some people are saying that that might have been a terrible gaffe by Kerry because it's such an impossible idea.
Well, you know, it's hard to tell at this point what is a gaffe by Kerry and what is intentional. You know, there was another statement that he made that the strike would be unbelievably small, which also seemed like a bit of a gaffe, as the administration seems to be straining to explain to a very skeptical public and a very skeptical Congress what the scope of this is and why, you know, seeming to simultaneously maintain that this will just be a safe little action, not a capital W war, but at the same time trying to explain why it's so necessary and what effect it would have. So I think, you know, Secretary Kerry has long been noted as not the most compelling public speaker in American politics, shall we say. And there are a couple of instances of him maybe providing less clarity than he would like.
Molly Ball, again, political reporter for The Atlantic Magazine. Karen Tumulty is national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Good to have you back on our program.
Hi, Warren. Hi, Molly.
Do you think that there is a kind of uncertainty that is unfolding on this day with the Secretary of State saying what he did, and now here comes Senator Feinstein saying, gee, maybe this is a good idea. Is the administration fumbling?
Yeah, well, this ball has taken a really wild bounce here because my understanding is from listening to other reporters that after Kerry made that comment about how essentially this could all happen within a week, the State Department had sent out, you know, sort of rockets to reporters saying, you know, he didn't mean that literally. He didn't mean that exactly that way. And then all of a sudden, what we see is the Russians somehow seizing an opportunity here, coming in and filling that vacuum with this proposal. So I think that this is very much, you know, a direction that the administration did not anticipate as Kerry made those comments.
Okay. Let me go back to Molly Ball. Once again, both party leaders, and the leaders of both parties, I should say, in both houses of Congress are favorable to the president's request. They're saying what Congress faces with regard to Syria is what they call a conscience vote. What does that mean?
The technical definition, the sort of Washington-speak term, is that's a vote on which all members of a particular caucus, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, get to vote in the way that they see fit, and pressure is not put on them by their respective leaders, John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi. So the idea being that this is an issue that really splits both parties, doesn't come down along partisan lines. While Pelosi and Boehner are both supportive of the administration's view on this, they are saying that they're not going to twist arms to get their members on board. Now, we are seeing, particularly from Pelosi, some pressure being put on. She sent a number of letters to Democrats in the House trying to persuade them. But it is a soft persuasion. It's not the type of really hard vote whipping that you would see with an issue where she was really exerting leadership.
What does the vote count look like now in both the House and the Senate?
The vote count does not look good for the White House. I'm looking right now at the Washington Post's ongoing tally. In the Senate, there are 23 senators who are for it, 19 who are against it, and 49 undecided, 9 leaning no.
And they need
In the
60.
House, it is Right, and they probably need 60. There probably will be a filibuster. In the House, only 26 members of the House have come out in favor. 119 have come out against, and another 119 are leaning against, with the rest undecided. And the trend that we've seen over the last week is those lean no's are turning into hard no's. There are not a lot of lean no's or even undecideds coming off the fence in favor of military action.
So, Karen Tumulty, the president really has his work cut out for him. In interviews he's going to do with all of the television news anchors this evening, and then in a speech that he's going to give to the American people tomorrow night.
It's really interesting. I've been trying to figure out if there's any kind of historic parallel to the situation that the president finds himself in. You know, it may be the FDR Great Arsenal of Democracy speech, where he, you know, persuaded a very reluctant nation to take the first steps into World War II. But the fact is that I think presidential powers of persuasion, even in earlier times, were not sort of what history likes to remember them as. I think presidents, as my colleague Dan Balls was writing yesterday, are really much more adept at kind of taking advantage of opportunities that exist. And right here, it's really hard to look at those vote totals that Molly was mentioning and see where the opportunities are for persuasion.
Speaking of history, there are other aspects about this session of Congress that seem to be historical as well. And let me go back to Molly Ball on this. We have, within 9 working days of the Congress, the possibility of a government shutdown. Is that right?
Yes. The Congress has only 9 working days this month on the calendar, and that is the deadline for them to produce a continuing resolution to continue to fund the government. Obviously, Syria is sucking up all the airtime in Washington right now, but they're really going to have to scramble to come to some kind of deal. What we've seen repeatedly over the last few years is that neither House can pass a budget or can together pass a budget, and so these continuing resolutions are the only way the government stays open, and they are continuously subject to brinksmanship and ultimatums. Combine that with the fact that you also have the debt limit about to be hit, I believe sometime in the next month, and you have a sort of double whammy that, again, historically in the recent past has caused a tremendous amount of acrimony and gridlock and near shutdowns.
And speaking of brinksmanship, Senator Cruz of Texas, new first year Republican with presidential ambition, is saying maybe one possibility is to fund all of the government except Obamacare, and then challenge the president to shut down the government over his own health care reform. Is Senator Cruz likely to get a lot of votes for that?
Well, yes and no. He is not the only senator calling for this. He's joined most prominently by his fellow sort of Tea Party senators, Rand Paul and Mike Lee. And there are another 10 senators who've signed on to this effort. 13 senators is not a lot. It's not even enough to block a filibuster. So in terms of where this is going in the Congress, it's not a popular idea. On the other hand, it's very popular with the conservative grassroots. We've seen throughout the August recess a lot of people showing up at rallies for this idea of defunding Obamacare, different conservative groups mounting an effort to keep it on the radar, and even running ads against some of the senators who don't support it. So I don't think it's an idea that's going away, and it's going to provoke a real confrontation, again, between the sort of Republican establishment and the Republican grassroots.
Tremendous implications for that. And then you mentioned the debt limit. Tell us a bit about the possible repercussions there. They could be worldwide. The global economy could be involved.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a Groundhog Day feel to all of this. I'm sure your listeners remember the last debt limit fight, and there's always this drama, and yet it always does get raised. So I think there's a temptation to say, oh, whatever, let's ignore it. They'll work it out. They always do. There's a lot of screaming and yelling, but eventually they come around. Well, every time is a struggle, and this is going to be no different. The parties are very far apart, and I don't want to predict anything one way or the other, except that it's going to be messy and awful.
Molly Ball with The Atlantic Magazine. Karen Tumulty, back to you with The Washington Post. What about the Syria vote and the way that it might or might not affect these other extraordinarily important issues? And we haven't even touched on them all.
Well, I think its primary effect is just going to be in the fact that it is proving to be, you know, a huge, huge distraction from this other business that was sort of going to take care under, you know, being taken care of under the ordinary course of events. And this is not a Congress that has had an ability to do more than one thing at once. That's how we end up with these continuing resolutions. I mean, it used to be that Congress would, in a very orderly fashion, pass actual appropriations bills over the course of the year. They don't seem even capable anymore of acting unless they are just at the absolute doorstep of a crisis.
Are there in the Constitution presidential authorities or any historical precedents for somebody to take charge under circumstances like this? Or are they so bound by the ruling documents of the founding documents of the country and the various procedural issues that they just simply have to slog through everything?
You mean in terms of the Syria issue, or
there are some
people who have urged that the president should take advantage of the full faith and credit clause in the Constitution to essentially assert that, you know, part of his job as the chief executive is to, you know, make sure that this country pays its debts, which would you know, stave off these kind of recurring debt ceiling fights that we have. But thus far, the White House, the president has been reluctant to do that. And of course, that would trigger yet another big fight here in Washington and certainly would end up in court.
And the president, of course, cannot control spending. That has to come from the Congress.
Yeah, but I've got to tell you, I mean, this idea, as Molly was mentioning, that Ted Cruz and others have floated, which is that, you know, if they pass this appropriations bill that doesn't have the new health care law in it, and then Obama vetoes it, somehow he would get blamed for it. I think that is a theory that is being circulated only by members of Congress who were not here in 1995. And, you know, somehow the idea that the president would get blamed for this, I think, is, you know, certainly not backed up by what happened the last time the government shut down.
When Newt Gingrich was the Speaker of the House and was basically put out of business as a result of that. Molly Ball, what about immigration reform? Is there any chance whatsoever for that?
What about immigration reform, indeed? Mm-hmm. This is all very bad news for anything else that people would like to see Congress do, because as Karen mentioned, this Congress at least is totally unable to walk and chew gum at the same time. So any time they are using on something else is time they are not using to consider immigration reform, which, after all, was not going to be an easy lift. This was not something that they could just sort of come in and vote on. There was already going to be a long process of the House insisting it was going to craft its own type of legislation, pass it in a piecemeal fashion with lots of hearings and a number of different bills on addressing different aspects. Immigration looks like it has been put off at least until very late this year, probably next year, if at all. And most of the observers of this issue believe that it is dying a slow death.
And Karen Tumulty, there's food stamps, SNAP, the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. The House has proposed slashing $20 billion out of that program over 10 years. Is that something that's just going to sort of ride along until next year, or will it be cut? Or do we have any way of predicting that?
It is absolutely impossible to predict that, given the fact that I do think it is going to be caught up in these other two big fiscal crises. And so it's almost impossible to predict how any individual program fares throughout this. I mean, these next few weeks, the next month, are going to be just so unpredictable.
All right. Molly Ball, again, a reporter for Karen Tumulty, whom we just heard from, a national correspondent at the Washington Post, specializing in politics. Molly Ball, political reporter for The Atlantic magazine. Great to have both of you on our program, although the news is not exactly reassuring. It's great to have both of you on our show. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
On our talking point later on, we'll be talking about a very unusual situation that's going to occur tomorrow in Silicon Valley. Not one, but two iPhones are going to be announced from Apple, and we'll find out why that is the case on our talking point. We'll continue with this conversation about what's going on in Washington in just a moment on To the Point from PRI.
Jump into a new mode of music discovery with the KCRW Music Mine.
It's our first iPad app dedicated entirely to music exploration. The Music Mind brings you an interactive experience with a constantly evolving galaxy of audio, video, and photos. Discover by artist, by DJ, or by song, and easily share the music you love with friends. The KCRW Music Mind. Dig into it on your iPad. More info at kcrw.com.
Warren Olley back with To The Point. As we've been hearing on our program today, Congress is in a position to either make history or perhaps more likely not make history or make history by not doing anything. I don't know quite how to put it. Our next two guests will help us find a way to better understand all of this. One a Democratic strategist, the other on the Republican side. Let's start with Ed Kilgore, Democratic strategist, managing editor of an online magazine called Democratic Strategist, devoted to discussion of long-range challenges facing the Democratic Party. Ed Kilgore, good to have you back on our show.
Great to be here, Warren.
So here we have, as we have heard from the outset of the program, a president who does not have the support of his own party, certainly yet does not have the support of the American people when it comes to this Syrian resolution. And now we have the Russians saying, wait a minute, maybe Assad can gather up all of his chemical weapons, turn them over to somebody else. And Dianne Feinstein, a solid Democrat, chair of the Intelligence Committee in the Senate, is saying maybe that's not a bad idea. How do you read the current uncertainties?
Well, I really think the first suggestion of this, you know, sort of way out of the impasse actually came from John Kerry.
That's right.
And then the Russians sort of leapt on it. David Cameron endorsed it. The Syrians themselves have indicated its possibility. So it's unclear to me whether Kerry meant that as a serious proposal or not, but now it is. And I think this could be a way out of a real political problem for the administration, at least temporarily, not simply because it would delay the need for a use of force resolution, but because the administration could claim that only a credible threat of force made this sort of solution possible to begin with. So that could change public opinion. It could even be a rationale for a contingent use of force resolution in Congress. And that's a very different proposition than what we've been hearing in terms of a direct use of force resolution.
Well, you're exactly right about how the White House is going to frame this. And earlier on the program, before you came aboard, we heard from the Deputy National Security Advisor saying that let's remember that this comes in the context of this threat of action. Therefore, we better keep the pressure up. How do we keep the pressure up if Congress doesn't vote for the president's proposal?
Well, as long as theoretically the administration could use force with or without a resolution, you could certainly keep the threat up. The timing is very dicey here. I wouldn't be terribly surprised if the use of force resolution in the Senate, if that vote is delayed. It's currently scheduled to happen on Wednesday, pending further negotiations. Or they could go ahead with a vote in the Senate, where prospects for approval have all along been much, much better, but then hold off on a House vote until we find out if, this solution of some sort of isolation and removal of chemical weapons storehouses could happen. But either way, it gives the administration new options and possibly more time to change public opinion and to, eliminate the impression that the administration is moving towards a serious strike that really neither party nor the public wants.
Ed Kilgore again with the online magazine Democratic Strategist. Let me turn to John Fieri, who is a Republican strategist, president of QGA Public Affairs. That's a strategic lobbying firm. He blogs at Fieri Theory. Good to have you on our show again.
Thanks, Warren. How are you doing?
Very well. So There's action scheduled for Wednesday. This will be after the president has spoken tonight to all of the television news anchors, and then tomorrow night delivered a speech to the American people. How do you read his challenge, particularly when it comes to trying to get the American people behind him? What the Congress members who have gone home have heard seems to be, according to the polls and the various town hall reports, nothing but opposition.
That's a great question. It seems that John Kerry kind of stumbled into a possible solution, whether he wanted to or not. You see Vladimir Putin jumping on this and Bashar Assad jumping on it. And, you know, a lot of people, including Joe Manchin from West Virginia, a lot of other members of the House and Senate, are looking for something other than to give the president an authorization to do a limited strike, because mostly they don't trust this president on the Republican side, especially that a limited option to do a limited strike would turn into a bigger option to go into a bigger war, which I think that the American people really do not want to do. They do not want to get involved in this Syria thing. If there's a way get an agreement that is not part of a limited strike, I think that everybody would kind of have a big sigh of relief.
You mentioned Senator Manchin from West Virginia. When he was in St. Petersburg last week, the president was asked about the alternative, sounding something like what Kerry had said earlier today and what the Russians and apparently the Assad government have leaped at. The president said he wasn't sure that was feasible, referring to the fact that there's all this stuff all over the country and that it would take a long time to clean it all up. And presumably the killing and the military action would continue in Syria after that, wouldn't it? How would that look if Congress said, no, you can't go in, and yet we continued to see slaughter?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that you'd have to do a two-step. First, you do this thing with the chemical weapons, then, you know, some sort of a peace conference and perhaps a ceasefire. And, you know, I'm not an expert in any of these things, but I can tell you this. Congress is not really that excited about giving the president this kind of authority, because they've seen in the past, not with this president, with others, that you take limited authority and you make it a bigger war, and their constituents are so overwhelmingly against it that they don't want to get involved. And, you know, I think that you see in the Congress that, as Ed pointed out, that the Senate has, you know, because only one-third of those guys are up for election, they probably have the votes, but the House, where everybody's up for election, you know, they don't have the votes, and you'll see the Senate perhaps go first and pass some sort of authorization if this other thing doesn't work out. And you might see that the House just kind of slow walk this and maybe never vote on it at all.
Ed Kilgore, back to you with Democratic Strategist. A real irony would seem that a president who ran against wars or any kind of military action, really, is now faced with the fact that his predecessor, who's a Republican, is the one who's now whose legacy was the bigger war made out of what appeared to be smaller initial efforts. What is all this going to mean for the other issues that we talked about before you guys came on the program, which would include the debt limit, the funding of the government, immigration reform, on and on and on? Ed Kilgore, is this Congress going to get anything done?
Well, I'm not sure it was going to get anything done. I mean, I'll simplify it. I think this will produce an excuse for congressional Republicans or House Republicans to drop any pretense of action on immigration reform, which they were almost certain to do anyway. You know, in terms of the fiscal collision, you know, House Republicans were already in quite a quandary as to, you know, what they could legitimately secure from the president using the threat of either a government shutdown or even a debt default. You know, Eric Cantor put out a memo today that a lot of cryptographers are trying to interpret right now that seemed to indicate that there would be a bunch of symbolic votes in the House on defunding Obamacare and this and that. But I think ultimately it sounds like their bottom line is that they will avoid a government shutdown and a debt default if the administration agrees to come in with domestic appropriations at the level of the next sequester.
And that's something that the administration might actually accept. So I think after a lot of thunder and lightning, we may have less of a fiscal collision than we might have thought, but it'll be amidst a lot of pointless symbolic votes, particularly in the House, to defund Obamacare, delay Obamacare, cut food stamps, you know, all the stuff that the base wants to hear. You know, but clearly I think immigration is gone for good, or at least until probably after the next election.
So, John Fieri, first to the issue of the fiscal issues. What about that? Do you think we'll see a lot of political drama signifying nothing, and that the Obama administration then will go ahead with the next sequester, which already is causing domestic difficulties for a lot of people?
Well, I do think that you'll see the status quo, and I think you will see political drama, because that's what we do here in Washington, D.C. That's kind of the beauty of Washington, is we do a lot of drama without a lot of production. I do think that ultimately you will have a continuation of the sequester, which is not a victimless sequester. It does, as you pointed out, Warren, has an impact on not only domestic discretionary spending, but also has an impact on defense discretionary spending. And I think that you will see the Republicans, especially guys like Lindsey Graham, who have a lot of defense in their states, are going to be pushing for some sort of relief from that defense sequester. I'm not sure if they're going to get that. I do think that one of the great things about the Syria problem is that it has kind of blown the Obamacare drive, defunding drive by Ted Cruz, kind of out of the water as the real issue coming out of August. And I think that gives the Republicans some room. But, you know, what you'll see quickly, you'll see a three-month CR perhaps to kind of kick this down the can, to kick this can down the road a little bit. And then at some point in time, maybe a series of small bills to deal with the debt limit, and then you'll have some of those bigger agreement, which will probably result in having the sequester stay in place, because I think that that's the one achievement that Republicans can point to about this domestic spending that has gone down to 2009 levels, and they can talk to their constituents about how they cut spending.
Ed Kilgore, on the other hand, as has been pointed out, defense spending, pretty important to Lindsey Graham and a lot of other Republicans as well. Is there any chance that if they demand some sort of relief from sequester, that the administration could say, okay, then let's have some relief on some of these domestic issues like food stamps and the other things?
Well, that's precisely what happened last year, and I think it'll have the same solution. It has been interesting to see some Republicans, even in the House, say, well, maybe we'll support you on Syria if you'll give the Pentagon some more money, because, after all, the Pentagon's not funded adequately to undertake big military missions, which is kind of hilarious, I think. But that's been the only real effort to link defense spending to much of anything else. So I think, yes, you'll hear Republicans demanding a relaxation of sequestration for the Pentagon. White House will demand relaxation of sequestration for domestic spending, and probably we'll have a status quo solution, would be my guess.
Okay, John Fieri, back to you. After the last presidential election, there was so much talk about immigration reform and the need for the Republican Party to reach out to the growing Latino vote. Why is it that the Republicans don't want to go ahead with immigration reform? What's holding them up?
Well, I don't know. I don't agree with that. I don't think it's dead yet. I think that Republicans will pass something at some point in time. My sense has always been that they'll pass it later in the year as opposed to earlier, and perhaps next year. I think that for most Republicans, what they see is a primary problem. If they vote for something that they want to do, which is immigration reform, they get a challenge from the right. If they can do it after the primaries, then it gives them a more of an opportunity. I mean, they're getting a lot of pressure, Republicans are, from the unlikely suspects. I mean, the corporate America obviously wants it, but a lot of religious groups, a lot of the Christian conservative groups want immigration reform. They see it, and they've been lobbying pretty effectively. So this thing is not dead yet. I think that also the grand strategists of the party understand that passing immigration reform is not necessarily going to get you Hispanic voters, but it's going to help you have a bigger conversation with Hispanics once you get this thing done. And they all, I mean, you know, guys like Karl Rove and others, they see the tea leaves. I mean, we cannot continue down this path. Well, there's been a kind of an active conversation about how we can still win with primarily the white vote. I think in the long term, you've got to be able to build out a bigger coalition if you want to be able to compete at the national level, especially at the presidential level.
This is a big issue in Republican districts, gerrymandered to be very strong and very conservative. Are you suggesting that the religious conservatives in districts like that could put off or blunt a primary challenge to a Republican who was in trouble because he or she had voted for some form of immigration reform?
No, I'm suggesting that they vote after the primaries are pretty much concluded.
So wait till next year.
Wait till next year. Yeah, I think that's always been kind of one of the things that Republican leadership has been thinking about. Just put this off. You don't have to vote on this year. Put it off till next year, later next year, after the primaries, and then perhaps finish it in a lame duck.
We heard earlier, Ed Kilgore, about conscience votes in Congress, such as the one on Syria, where the leadership doesn't, or at least doesn't appear to be putting on a whole lot of pressure. But obviously, every Congress member is looking at, as was pointed out earlier, next year's elections. What do you think are the main issues for Democrats and Republicans at this point? Is it even possible at this point to talk in terms of which party might ultimately end up, or which House, rather, might ultimately end up in the control of which party?
You asked me, Warren?
Yeah.
It's way too early. There are a lot of reasons for Republican optimism in 2014 that have almost nothing to do with actual issues or even that much to do with public opinion. Republicans have a built-in advantage because of the nature of the electorate that turns out in midterms. We saw that in 2010. And they have a huge landscape advantage in the Senate because the bulk of competitive Senate seats in 2014 are held by Democrats, some in red states. And then they have a gerrymander and incumbent advantage in the House. So this is a very tilted landscape for Republicans. Probably the biggest issue is whether they have a realistic chance of taking back the Senate. But none of this is a referendum on Obama or a precursor of 2016 or any of the stuff we're going to hear. It's just the nature of term elections, and particularly this one.
John Fieri, 15 seconds left. Do you agree with that?
I think it's going to be a referendum on how Obama's doing. And I think for Republicans, it's fratricide. If they decide that they're going to spend more of their time beating each other up, they could make it easier for the Democrats to make some inroads in 2014.
Okay. Politics always rears its ugly head when we have these conversations. John Fieri, Republican strategist, president of QGA Public Affairs. Thanks a lot for being on our program, blogging at The Fieri Theory. Ed Kilgore, Democratic strategist with an online magazine of that name, Democratic Strategist. Always good to have you on our program as well. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
One of the new iPhones expected from Apple tomorrow will feature advanced new technology and higher prices. So why, for the first time, is another new iPhone also expected that's both more basic and cheaper? We'll talk about that in a moment on To The Point.
Check out our new YouTube video channel, The Q. KCRW DJs curate themed video playlists and feature artist clips straight from YouTube. Add some visual to your audio. Explore now at kcrw.com/theq.
Warren Olney back with today's talking point, tomorrow's unveiling of two new iPhones. It's all going to take place at Apple headquarters in Cupertino, as it always does. Ina Fried will be there. She is senior editor for All Things D. She is one who reported this announcement all the way back in August. Ina Fried, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here, Warren.
Tell us, first of all, how certain it is that there's going to be not one but two.
Well, we're pretty sure at this point. The rumors have been pretty consistent. But, of course, it is all rumors at this point. You know, Apple has just said, come and let us show you our stuff, and they haven't, as usual, said anything themselves. But I think all the indications are, and these huge factories in China now leak fairly significantly, which didn't happen before. Anyway, so we've seen pictures of what appear to be two different models. One is expected, you know, a new high-end model likely to be called the iPhone 5S. But the more interesting one is, for the first time, a new model that's not at the high end, that's not a new flagship model, but actually more of a low-cost device.
That's being called the iPhone 5SC, is that right?
5C is what it's
called. 5C, excuse me, okay.
Called.
What's the C for?
Well, two things. One, you could say it's C for color because it's going to come in plastic reportedly and have different colors. But really the C in a lot of people's mind is for China. And that's the market that we think Apple is mostly going after with this new model, which is this huge growing market in China where they have a growing appetite for smartphones, but not as big a budget as a lot of folks here in the States.
So what will be the difference then in capacity, do you think, between the new expensive one with bells and whistles and the other one for the Chinese and others who want brightly colored ones?
I think probably it's just going to be a little bit lower in cost. People are calling it the low-cost iPhone, but I think that's going a little bit far. This is really a mid-range phone. You know, in China and a lot of the world, people are used to paying $100 or $150 without a subsidy for these phones, and Apple's not going to hit that target. So I think it'll be similar to the current iPhone, a little bit less expensive casing and sort of fit and finish, as they call it, materials and so forth, but a lot of the capabilities that people have come to expect in the iPhone 5.
What about the capabilities that they haven't seen before that the new iPhone 5S is likely to have? How do you what do you think they're going to get?
So Apple typically does the big upgrade every other year and then a more modest upgrade. This year we're due for a more modest upgrade. It seems like that's what we'll get. Typically the kinds of things you see every year are faster processors and better cameras. They almost get that for free. The semiconductor industry just churns out better chips every year, and that's what you get. The other thing we're expecting to see is a fingerprint sensor. Apple bought a company a little while back called Authentec that makes these very small fingerprint sensors, and that could be really useful for replacing the passwords, which we're all tired of remembering, don't do a very good job with. So being able to swipe our finger, if it works well, could be a welcome relief and added security.
If it works well, of course, is the operative phrase there, it seems to me. What if it doesn't work? Would you still have to go to your password or be able to go to your password?
I'm sure there would be a backup that if for some reason it's not reading your finger well, you can enter a password. When we've seen these on computers and so forth, that's typically been the way they've worked. And they've ranged from not very good a decade ago to pretty darn good. The interesting thing is Authentec, the company that Apple bought, makes most of these sensors. So the technology has actually disappeared from the market. You won't find many laptops or phones that have a fingerprint sensor because Apple really gobbled up the leader in the space. So it's almost reintroducing a capability that we've seen in the past that's been largely absent the last year or two.
This would be really important from a security standpoint. Millions of iPhones are stolen all the time.
And that, I think, is going to be an increasing conversation, not just with Apple, but all the smartphone makers. Right now, if your iPhone gets stolen, you can reset it and get the data, keep the data from falling into the wrong hands, but chances are that phone can be shipped overseas and reused somewhere else. A bunch of government officials, both in the U.S. and New York and California, as well as the mayor of London, have called on the phone makers to put a kill switch. And the new version of iOS, iOS 7, does have something along those lines that help prevent a phone that's been stolen from being reactivated. The hard part is, in order to be a deterrent, you really have to have a lot of phones out there with a kill switch so that the thieves turn their attention to something other than smartphones. Go back to wallets, I don't know.
How does this action by Apple relate to the fact that recently Microsoft bought Nokia, the previously the biggest maker of smartphones in the world? How do these particular developments fit together?
I think we're seeing a lot of the companies sort of converge on each other's business practices. So for years, Microsoft made the software, let other people make the hardware, and they made huge margins. Increasingly, though, the world has moved towards an Apple-like model where one company really does the hardware and the software. We've seen that with Microsoft buying Nokia. Also, Google bought Motorola. Apple, on the other hand, for years has concentrated on the high end and let others sort of do the mid-range. I think they're seeing the limits of that business model, and so they're trying to have a broader approach. The bottom line is this is a huge market. Phones is really the can't-miss opportunity for all of these technology companies, and they're all betting extremely heavily to try and better position themselves. Right now, Apple and Samsung dominate the market, but Microsoft clearly wants back in. Google would like to have an even stronger position than it does, and Apple wants to keep the position they have and expand it if they can.
And once again, China is vital to these changes.
Sure. I mean, if you think about the size of the Chinese market, You know, if one company could really win in China, they would have a huge share of the global market. And it's also one of the fastest growing smartphone markets. But a lot of that market right now is dominated by companies that you don't necessarily hear of in the U.S. There's a company, Xiaomi, that's done really well. That's a bunch of ex-Google employees. Lenovo's certainly done well. So the American and the Korean and some of the global names have had a harder time in China than they have elsewhere in the world.
You said earlier that Apple tends to have a big upgrade every other year, and that this is the middle year when they may not have as much as they sometimes do. Is this going to force this? Are these changes in the industry in general going to force Apple to upgrade more significantly on a yearly basis rather than waiting every 2 years?
It's actually a question I'm exploring in a piece that I'm working on right now. I think they will. I mean, I think there was a time when the iPhone was so far ahead of the competition that they could afford to upgrade once a year and really only a major upgrade every 2 years. But the industry is moving so fast, it's a little hard to imagine a world lasting much longer where Apple can afford to really only change its designs every other year in a market where it seems like there's a new phone every week.
So this is no longer the world of Steve Jobs, who died 2 years ago and was remembered as the person who had probably more influence over the computer age than anybody else.
I think the era of products that Steve directly influenced is probably at an end. There's some reason to believe that he was helping them with a television project. So there might be one more product, but I think we've really reached the end of the products that he directly touched. And now the question is, how much of that sense of style, that sense of innovation, has really been inculcated the entire company? And will they be able to prove, you know, as some critics are worried, that they can sort of continue that without Steve directly involved?
Also a change, you would indicate, in strategy when they're coming out with not one iPhone but two in order to appeal to the, if not the lower market, the middle market.
It is a shift, although it's not clear that they're going to hit that much more of the market. What Apple has done in the past is just kept around the old models. So they still sell the iPhone 4S and indeed the iPhone 4, and they sell a lot of them. So what they're betting now is that more of the market would prefer a newer model at that lower price than last year's model or the year before's.
Do you get to buy both because you write about all of this? Or if not, which one are you going to buy yourself?
Well, so, you know, I get to play around with them all for a limited time. Certainly, you know, I try and make sure I'm running. But in terms of the one that's under contract, I have an iPhone 5, and I'm 1 year into a two-year contract. So, you know, I probably wouldn't pay the several hundred dollars to break my contract to get what we would imagine would be a modest improvement.
Ina Fried, senior editor for All Things D, working with the same issues as everybody else. Great to have you on our program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Warren.
I'm Warren Olney. Thanks again for joining us on For To The Point, produced live and podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.